In section 12, chapter 12, we're going to be getting involved in the actual, basically what you call the negotiation of the contract, actually making the offer to purchase, counteroffer, and going through the period called the escrow or closing, going through a thing called bulk sale, also filing a financing statement, and going through the different areas that basically are at the end of the transaction, or for those of you that are brokers, you're basically in the middle. In other words, you've already put the information together, you've gotten a listing, you're now going to sell it to somebody. So we're going through the different purchase area here, and as you look at the purchase document on page 12.1, I'm not going to take you through every area. What I'd like you to do is use this as a guide when you're drawing up a contract, or if you're having an attorney draw up a letter of intent or some short document, fine. Now, the thing I want to warn you on, you start putting a transaction together, I don't want to put down my attorney friends, but the thing you have to realize is if you bring the attorneys in too soon, your chance of putting a transaction goes down quite a bit. And it's not the attorneys don't do a good job. Is what we try to do is we try to get a basic agreement between buyer and seller in writing, which is 3 or 4 pages long, or maybe 5 pages, and then later go to the attorney. Now, again, the attorney can say, well, you should have come to me first. Well, you can go to the attorney. You can check with him. But if you start getting him in there, monkeying around with it right in the beginning, and the buyer has one and the seller has one, you're going to find that your chance of ever putting the transaction becomes very small. So what we do is we try to take the pressure off the back of the attorney by going through the standard things that we normally want agreement on, which is the price, the terms, whether they're going to stay or not, the down payment. And these are things, basically, that is something that the buyer and seller agree to based on how they feel. The attorneys, basically, should be protecting you in the other areas. The CPA should be protecting you in the area of taxation. And getting back to the attorneys, they should be protecting you in the area that has to do with legal protection and not getting in the other area of saying, gosh, that is not a high enough price. That is not enough a down payment. And although attorneys may be very bright in a lot of areas, I still have not met very many attorneys that know anything about pricing a business, even though they profess and give their clients information in that area. And the same thing with CPAs. And the problem is you put them in a position where they have to overprotect you. What you should be considering doing, again, it's up to you to decide, you should be considering using some short-form agreement. Again, it could be a one-page letter of intent that your attorney could draw up and then further refine it. Or do what we do here, which is a short-form purchase agreement. You can either use a state document that is available in your state or use our example here. And incidentally, if you do use the state form, you're going to find it really doesn't cover enough. And we've looked at all of them. And what we suggest you do then is go through here and pick out the areas your state form doesn't cover and pull our paragraphs out and use them as addendums to the contract. Now, you have to realize we're not trying to beat the attorneys out of anything. And also, the contracts we use in any agreements have been drawn up by attorneys. We pay attorneys for doing this over and over again. So we're not beating them out of anything. You're also going to find as we go through this later in this section, we're going to have the attorneys then come in as we have agreement on the short form, and the attorneys then will take the short form and expand it. And what we've also found, if the attorneys find something blatantly wrong with what the agreement is, the agreement can still always be modified between buyer and seller by going back. But the thing is, we try to keep the attorneys and the other people out of areas that basically is none of their business. Again, protecting the client is their business. But the thing is, getting them out of areas that they really don't have expertise in, but yet do make comments to their client in. I know I'm going to get a lot of nasty letters from attorneys now. The purchase agreement now. Let's start going through it. Let's talk about the deposit. Many of you think that when you're putting up a deposit, or earnest money, whatever you want to call it, which is money to get the seller to pull the business off the market, you think a lot of money has to be put up. Well, it can be a token amount, or what you can do is what we do most of the time. We use a promissory note. Where do you get promissory notes from? You can get them from the stationery store. The promissory note, you buy a pack of them, you'll have enough to buy business for your lifetime. Now, on a promissory note, what we normally do is we put up a promissory note as a down payment or earnest money, and on it we write that this money will be substituted by cash on or before the close, or we will then put up cash for this note after the offer is accepted. We don't like to put it up when it's accepted because things can still go wrong. What we'd rather have you do is put it up at some point in the transaction after everything has been verified, after all the contingencies have been lifted, maybe even after your CPA has checked the business out. Because if you don't do this, we end up with a problem in the business. The other thing I want to warn you on, when you do run into a business and you do have to put up cash, what we normally do, we'll open up 2 escrows or 2 neutral accounts. One will be on the business and the other one will be set up stating that this money as a down payment or deposit will not be funded to the regular escrow or closing until after the following conditions have been met. Because what happens, we find in most cases, if there is misrepresentation, most of it is on the part of the seller. And usually what the seller is trying to do is get money in their hand. They then end up misrepresenting, which causes the buyer to back out. And the buyer then has trouble getting the money. Why? Because it's already in the hands of the seller. So we are usually trying to figure out some method, whether we're representing the buyer or the seller, to keep that money in a neutral account as long as possible. And the reason for it is when we do have the problems, it makes it a lot easier to pull the buyer and seller apart and undo the transaction. Now, again, we start talking about this promissory note. For those of you that have fantasies about the fact that sellers are not going to accept these notes, if the seller comes to you and said, and if you need a recourse, and say to them, look, I don't want a promissory note, I want money. Well, when they come to me and ask for that, what I would say to them basically is, look, if I have to take money out of accounts that I have that are interest-bearing or on something like stock I'm going to have to pay tax on and put it up on this transaction, how do I know it's going to go ahead? Now, if you insist I put it up, yes, I will. But since most of the misrepresentation is on the part of the seller, I'd like you, the seller, to put up an equal or greater amount of money in an account and have that account say that if this transaction does not go ahead because the seller has misrepresented, this money is given to the buyer. In all the years I've been doing this, every time I bring this up as a thought to the seller then backs off and said the promissory note will be fine. And incidentally, from a legal standpoint or from the attorney's standpoint, having a promissory note is not that bad. Why? It gives the seller access to all the assets of the buyer, not just the cash. It's an easy way to go. We do it all the time, especially in the larger businesses. The next thing, again, we're talking about the price and terms, assets, liabilities. When you get down to allocation in here, this is allocation based on a couple of things. First of all, there's a couple of different ways you can buy a company or sell a company. And if you're looking at the bottom of 12.1 and over the first part of 12.2, you're going to find we have allocated. We have broken down the value of the business into its basic parts. When you're talking to your CPA, you're going to find that maybe the buyer and seller have agreed to a price of $100,000. You now are going to break the price down into its basic components to get tax benefits to buyer or tax benefits to seller. Now, this is in a sole proprietorship you allocate, or if you're buying the assets and liabilities of a corporation. If you're buying the stock in a corporation, you're not going to be allocating on the offer to purchase. Why? All you're doing is buying the stock. You're just buying the stock. So if you're buying assets or liabilities, to repeat, or if you're buying a sole proprietorship, you're going to find that you are able to do a thing called allocating. And as you sit down with your CPA, he or she will break this down for you tax-wise. And again, you're going to have agreement between buyer and seller on this. The other thing we mention, as you go into the paragraph under this allocation, it says, an actual inventory shall be taken by buyer and seller at the time of closing, and adjustments, if any, shall be made at the completion of inventory. Any variation in excess of a certain percentage between estimated and actual values for either the receivables, which is A, or the inventory, which is B, shall give the buyer the option of terminating the agreement. And the reason we put that in there is sometimes in the transaction, the amount of inventory or the accounts receivable can vary so much that it could kill a transaction. And what we're doing now is giving the buyer the opportunity to spell out what variation they can live with. And again, don't come back and ask me what the amount is. 10% of $100,000 is only $10,000, and you could possibly live with that. But if it were $1 million and 10%, could you live with a $100,000 variation if you use 10? So what you're going to have to do is work this backwards and use your common sense. But you're going to find it's going to help you. You're also going to find as you go through the agreement, we have a number of things in here that discuss different areas, buyer's remorse and seller's remorse, and spell it out for you. So read the different areas. Now keep in mind also this document was developed a long time ago to protect both the buyer and the seller. And you're going to find if you happen to be a buyer, you may not want to use all the paragraphs. And the same thing from the standpoint, if you're working from the seller's standpoint, you may find all the paragraphs may not apply to what you're trying to use. So just don't blatantly or in total, take the form and sign it and use it because you're going to find there's maybe a paragraph or two in there that are not to your benefit. If you look at page 12.9, there's a thing called covenant not to compete. And it's something that a lot of you asked me about, and this is the agreement not to compete. In this example right here, it's included as part of the original document. As you or your CPA check the law, you're going to find that this has to be a separate written document. So as you get into the escrow or closing period, whoever's handling the paperwork, such as the attorney, will have to draw up a separate document for the non-competition agreement. But basically, all the non-competition agreement says is the fact that the seller will not compete with the buyer for a radius of so many miles and also for so many years. We find in certain parts of the United States, the non-competition agreement may not be valid. They may have, such as Montana, you may have a rule that states that you only can have non-competition within the county. Or in Honolulu, they don't allow the non-competition law from the standpoint of the legal side. The reason for that is if you set up a 50-mile non-competition in Honolulu, the person would probably have to go to Australia. The thing you have to remember in the covenant not to compete or the non-competition is you have to keep it fair. Because you're going to find the courts are not going to allow you to set up a non-competition agreement that will keep the buyer or the seller from ever gaining employment or feeding their family. So you're going to have to make sure it's fair. You're also going to find out in the area of years, you're going to be able to write it off based on the number of years. So if the non-competition agreement happens to be for a value of $100,000 and it's for a five-year period, the buyer can write off $20,000 a year. IRS then just tries to keep it in line by saying, we would like you to have the non-competition agreement not go beyond your normal life. In other words, the insurance companies have put out actuarial tables based on that if you're at a certain age as a man or woman, you will probably live so many years based on their statistics. The government then uses this to make sure you don't go beyond that period. Okay, and again, I'm not trying to give you a complete definition. I just want you to understand that in this program. As we finish this contract, basically what you're going to have is the buyer and seller are sitting down and they're negotiating. You're going to have things called counteroffers, where the buyer is going to make an offer to the seller is not going to like certain things, and counteroffer back. And by the time you're finished, even though you're starting with a small document, you may end up with a couple of more pages as buyers or sellers want to make changes in the original document. Eventually, if you've done your homework, you'll get to the point where you do have agreement between buyer and seller. Now, in the contract we're just talked about here, I want you to realize there's one basic thing we've left out. And that's called the contingencies. And if you look at page, or the next page we have here, you're going to find that we have a thing called contingencies. Now, contingencies are also known as weasel clauses. And again, please don't call them weasel clauses in a contract or in a negotiation, or you'll screw it up because you'll scare the seller. But again, if you want to go full disclosure, that's what they are. Contingencies mean, basically, this contract is subject to the following things happening. An example here, the buyer's example. It says the purchase is subject to inspection and approval in writing of the books and records by the buyer. And what you have to realize here, from a buyer's standpoint, you have to sign off on these things. I also want you to realize as a buyer, you don't have to go back and explain to the seller why you didn't like the books. You don't have to explain to the seller that you didn't like page 7, 8, and 9 in the journal. What you have to do is if you check the books and you don't like them, do not sign off and approve them. Okay? And also beware of people that write the contracts in reverse. And what they end up doing is they'll put it down, and again, I can't quote it exactly, but it'll say that the buyer will have so many days to verify and check the books, which say 10 days. If at the end of the 10-day period they have not notified the escrow in writing that they don't like the books, the contract will then assume that we're going forward. In other words, if you don't go back as a buyer and tell them in writing that you didn't like it and tell them specifically what it was, then you have to go ahead with the contract. Do not get trapped into that. Now, in all the years I've been working with people that have it that way, it's usually something that comes from the business brokerage community. And again, of all the times I've seen it, I have also found if I have further checked these brokerage firms, they also try to rip off people in other areas. Is that a ripoff? Yes, because what they're trying to do is rip you off in the negotiation. The next thing is we say, or the purchase is subject to inspection approval of writing of the equipment by the buyer. These give basically a buyer away of the agreement. And again, if you're doing a good job as a buyer, you've basically gotten the seller to take the business off the market. You've gotten the seller to agree to certain things, and you then have a way out. The thing you have to realize is you get involved in financing. If you have gotten the owner to carry back financing for 75%, and then you hit the owner with a contingency that said, this is subject to my borrowing the 25% down and $4 million other dollars, what you're going to find is the seller is going to get very upset with you. Because even though the seller has said to you, this is what I want, I would like to get 25% down and I will finance the other 75% over so many years, they get very uptight when they know you don't have the financing. Because basically what it is, when a person comes in to a seller and the seller said to the buyer, do you have a financial statement? In small businesses like mom and pops or little startups. You're going to find they want the financial statement because they want to check your cash flow to make sure you can make the debt payments because the business wouldn't have a lot of money or none. When you get into the larger businesses, over 50,000, most owners are not asking for a financial statement because they want to find out where the secondary source of repayment or how are you going to repay the money, because the business you're buying can repay it and do it safely. What they're trying to find out in your financial statement is, can they see on your financial statement where you're going to get the down payment from? Again, the basic thing you're looking at is they want proof that you can't come up with the money. Very few sellers really care where their money's coming from. But what they like to do is make sure you're not a tire kicker, and they want to make sure that if you agree to give them 25% down, that you can deliver on it. And that's the key thing. I'm not going to say the other never exists, but that's the key thing they're looking for. Now, what you're going to find is, for those of you representing as sellers, if you're a seller and listening to this, you have to realize we're teaching this from two sides. And what you should do is counteroffer, because what happens is if the person buying the business comes in and offer tells you that they want this subject to inspecting the books and there's no date on it, that means that you can keep this thing open forever. So what you should do is consider counteroffering. When they put down the purchase is subject to inspection and approval in writing, you should put down that you have to do it within 10 days. Or if they want to inspect the equipment, within 3 days. And again, I'm not recommending that this be the period. You should put something down. This enables you to cut them off, and you have counteroffered. And they then have to make that decision. If they haven't made that decision and signed off in that time, you don't have to go ahead with a contract. Now, keep in mind, if an offer has been made and there's a counteroffer that said that you have to do it within 10 days, and you're the buyer, and say your CPA has not had a chance to get finished in 10 days, you still can go back to the seller and get the thing changed. Don't be afraid of that. But do spell out all the details. Spell out all the details. Now, what I'd like you to do now is we're going to turn to the back side, just flip the page over, and you're going to find now we're going to start talking about the escrow, the closing, the consummation of the transfer from buyer to seller. In other words, we're going to be taking this to a period now. We've gotten the buyer and seller to agree to terms. We've gotten to sign off on it. Now, before you do this, before you start to go out and open up an escrow or open up or go through the closing period or bring the attorneys in or the CPAs, I want you to realize I want you to get the financing done first. Now, I don't mean to say I don't want you to hire the CPAs or the accountants or the attorneys on an a la carte basis to check contracts and do various things. But we normally do not bring them in to do the major billing and the major checking until after we have all the basic things done. Why? Because too many things can still go wrong. So before you open up the escrow or start incurring a lot of expense, what I'd like you to consider doing is get the contingencies out of the way. Like, number one, do you have a financing problem? Are you still having trouble with the down payment? Have you gotten approval from the bank? Have you worked with your suppliers? Whatever. If you haven't done that, what I want you to do, as soon as the thing is signed off, before you commit yourself to spending any money as a buyer, I want you to sidestep down the street and take care of your financing. As soon as you've taken care of your financing then, come back and do the thing you've called open up the escrow. Sit down with the attorney. Sit down with the CPA. But don't do it before you have all these things done. Why? Because if you don't do that, you'll end up committing yourself to a lot of money, and the transaction will not go ahead, and you'll have to waste that money. And again, knowing full well that you're going to have to spend the same large amount of money in the next one. So please do it in the right order. Take your time. Now, once you've arranged whatever you have to arrange, financing, whatever, we then consider going to what we call the escrow or closing period. And if you look at the sheet, it says the consummation of the transfer from seller to buyer. Again, the consummation. Quite often we're using an attorney. And we usually recommend using an attorney because they're also required to handle and expedite the legal work. Now, again, we have over the years tried to work with banks, title companies, and escrow companies, and although in some areas we do have exceptional ones we've worked with, we have found over the years that they don't do a good job in our area. They also tend to make comments about the legal part of the transaction or the tax part of it, or just say, what kind of a Mickey Mouse deal is this? And what happens is we have a hard time keeping people that know nothing more than how to shuffle papers from giving legal advice or giving tax advice. And again, we've just had bad experiences with them. If you happen to have a good one, fantastic. In fact, we'd love it if you come back and recommend them after you get done using them, because having good people in this area to work with would be fantastic. But we haven't had that. We haven't found that over the years. The next thing I want to talk about here is the actual purchase agreement, because what we're talking about here on this page under B is we're talking about the long firm. And we're saying pages and pages of protection for buyer and seller and brokers. Do not be tempted to use a short form to carry through the full transaction. Now, in the past, have I seen things go through with a short form? Yes, I have. Have I also seen a lot of lawsuits because of that? Yes, I have. And what I'd like to suggest you do is take your time and go the right way. It may be a little more expensive, but you're going to find that once the attorneys take the three words where we have agreement between buyer and seller and expand the three words out to 50, 500, whatever it happens to be, it'll add a lot of other boilerplate, which is just standard paragraphs, you're going to find that you're going to find fewer lawsuits. You're also going to find fewer buyers and sellers pulling out. Why? It's very easy in your mind to take three words of agreement between you and the other party and twist them and say, well, I can get out of this. Once they get it up to many, many words, you're going to find that most people don't back out because the reality hits them right in the face when they sit down and read that long paragraph and said, oh, it isn't as I thought it was. Why? Because it's been spelled out with a lot of words. And although I don't like having to go to long contracts, I have found over the years you have to do it. You have to spend the money. And for those of you listening that are still thinking about, gosh, I'm not going to go through an attorney. I'm not going to use a CPA. Number one, every person in the transaction needs an attorney. Every person in the transaction needs a CPA that knows what they're doing. In fact, you're going to have to find an attorney and CPA that understand business. You're not looking for a divorce attorney. You want an attorney that has done this before a number of times. You want a CPA that knows how to check books. You're not looking for a CPA that has worked as a controller for a large corporation. You have to have somebody that can help you. Just because they have the title doesn't mean they have the experience or that they should be working in this area. As we turn the page now, we start to get involved in an area that is very interesting. It's a thing called a bulk sale. And the bulk sale is broken into two divisions. The one we have in the section here in the book is from the California Uniform Commercial Code. But you're going to find that it is very easy and very similar to the national. And let me explain it from a national and a state standpoint. Many years ago, the Uniform Commercial Code was developed at the national level. And what has happened since then, as far as I know, all the states we have been in, they have adopted the Uniform Commercial Code. The only one we have found that has been a little different has been the one in Louisiana. But over the years, every state we have worked in has had the Uniform Commercial Code. And what has happened is the states then have varied the Uniform Commercial Code that was set up at the national level and set it up for their own level. The reason we use California is most of the people we work with are from the California area, and we also find that the Uniform Commercial Code in California is the best one to use in a teaching situation because it is the California area is the toughest one. California is the one that other ones normally follow. And that doesn't mean that California is a leader. What we find generally is California leads in the area of fraud. And since I happen to be from the state, I'm not criticizing another state.
This concludes Side 1. To continue, please turn the cassette over.